Chapter 3, Anxiety and Stress. Fear and worry are painful but necessary emotions. Fear enables us to respond rapidly to a threat, and worry helps us anticipate and prepare for future dangers. Because these emotions are so strong, they tend to stay around long after they are useful. Instead of relaxing completely after a stressful event, we tend to settle back into that state of habitual, low-level arousal that we call anxiety. We can regard anxiety as maladaptive, toxic fear. Fear and worry are helpful. They are focused on likely dangers and problems. Anxiety, however, is directed indiscriminately towards everything. Fear sharpens the mind and heightens our perceptions. Anxiety just makes us agitated and confused, feeling bad and not knowing what to do about it. Fear is short-lasting, and worry should come and go according to circumstances, but anxiety can stay for a lifetime. About 10 to 20% of the population are likely to be suffering from anxiety at any one time, and it is a common component of other maladies. People with free-floating anxiety are often diagnosed as having a generalized anxiety disorder. About a quarter of such people will also face the horror of panic attacks. These sudden eruptions of paralytic fear can occur without any trigger and are often mistaken for heart attacks. Many anxious people develop phobias. They fixate their fears on particular stimuli and organize their lives to avoid them. Others will develop obsessive-compulsive disorder and fix on time-consuming preventative rituals to stay in control. Anxiety also tends to be the precursor to and a common component of both depression and schizophrenia. Although fear seems to be instinctive, it is actually a learnt response. Babies aren't born with the full complement of emotions. Fear comes at about 6 months, anger at about 12 months. Shame takes 2 years. This is good news. Because fear is learnt, it can be unlearnt or new patterns learnt around it. Meditation as a stress management tool is very much about winding back and retraining the fear response. To do this, it is useful to understand how fear works in the brain. Fear occurs as an interaction between three brain regions. These are the frontal cortex, where thinking occurs, the sensory cortex, where sensing occurs, and the limbic system, where emotions occur. The word cortex means skin. It refers to the top few millimeters of the brain. Thinking occurs exactly where we would expect it to, behind our foreheads in the frontal cortex. Sensing occurs in specialized regions throughout the rest of the cortex. Our emotions occur in the center of the brain in a region loosely called the limbic system. This is where we find the amygdala, which determines the strength of any emotional response, and the hypothalamus, which both initiates and winds back that response. When the sensory cortex notices a potential danger, it sends the information simultaneously to the amygdala and to the frontal cortex. The amygdala processes the data rapidly and crudely. The frontal cortex processes it slowly and more accurately. The amygdala makes a quick and dirty approximate assessment, such as, "This could be a snake." Within a third of a second, it is triggered off a fight or flight response via the hypothalamus, just in case. This makes good biological sense. A mouse that bolts at the possibility of a predator will survive longer than one that hangs around until it's sure. There is no way we can avoid this initial blind impulse. Emotion always starts as a fast, automatic overreaction. At the same time, however, the thinking brain is making its own more accurate assessment. It takes a good second to verify the details, for example, whether it really is a snake, and to consider options. Since the situation is rarely as bad as the amygdala assumes, the thinking brain winds back the stress response that is already underway to a more appropriate level. The final behavioral outcome results from this crosstalk between thought and emotion. Thought alone can't decide what to do. Emotions often get it wrong, but they do give us our value judgments and our drive. We need them both. Because our emotions operate by impulse, we have surprisingly little direct awareness of them. We are more likely to notice stress in terms of its bodily or mental effects. In the last chapter, I explained how stress affects the body. In this chapter, I will explain how it affects the mind. Anxiety typically leads to an overactive, runaway mind. Our thoughts take over. We can't stop them or direct them. We overreact to everything indiscriminately. A clear sign of stress is that even small problems feel like crises. Even when we are exhausted, the mind doesn't give up, and its incessant chatter can keep us awake at night. Anxiety increases the rate at which we burn energy. We first feel charged up, but once we burn through our reserves, we become exhausted. This means we can feel anxiety both as high energy agitation or as low energy lethargy and confusion. In the high energy state, the mind is too fast. It moves too rapidly from one thought to another. It is easily distracted and can't concentrate. It constantly scans for danger or advantage. It jumps from one thought to another on impulse without reflection, and it spends too little time with any one issue to think about it productively. It is good to realize that shifting attention at any time is an expensive activity. We lose energy and a few seconds each time we shift focus and have to adjust to another thought or action. Multitasking is one of the most wasteful activities we can attempt to do. For mental efficiency, it is so much better to slow down, pay attention, and keep the thought switching to a minimum. If the mind is too speedy, we leave behind a trail of unfinished, ill-digested activity and often have to return to patch up afterwards. In the low energy state, the mind gets too tired to focus at all. It drifts uncontrollably from one thought to another at the mercy of any distraction, or it defaults to its habitual worries. It can't follow a train of thought productively and often just spaces out. When we are tired, we can still function and apparently get through the day. However, we are usually not alert enough or sufficiently tuned in to evaluate what we are doing or to remember in any detail what we've done. This combination of low energy, scattered attention, scrappy performance, and poor recall can make us feel we're not coping well at all. This is how habitual anxiety, the high energy state, often leads inexorably into depression, the low energy state. There are three main ways in which meditation helps with anxiety and the overactive mind. It relaxes the body. It shifts our attention away from thought into the sensory present, and it slows down and objectifies those thoughts that remain. Does this through the three skills I've mentioned earlier, namely relaxation, focusing, and self-awareness. Relaxation counteracts emotion. The purpose of emotion is to fire the body up for immediate action. Relaxation, however, diffuses this muscular tension and over-arousal. Even a few deep breaths are quite enough to start the process. Within a minute or so, the body is no longer primed to shoot first and ask questions later. You're no longer overreacting or indeed reacting at all. The emotional charge fades and the thoughts lose their driving urgency. Focusing calms the overactive mind in a different way. To focus means to give one thing priority at the expense of everything else. We feed X by starving Y. Our thoughts usually run along automatically if left to themselves. If we deliberately focus on the body, however, we drain energy away from that habitual process. The weakest thoughts will vanish. Any thoughts that remain will become weaker and more controllable. This alone is often an enormous relief to an anxious person. Meditation also helps by developing self-awareness, or what is called mindfulness. This is about learning to see troublesome thoughts and emotions objectively, as an observer, thereby gaining more control over them. It is basically a stop and look before you act mechanism, and it arrests our tendency to run with thoughts. To be aware of a thought or emotion means that you can see it clearly, evaluate its importance, and consciously choose to respond to it or not. Meditation traditionally makes use of language to capture and contain thoughts in much the same way that cognitive behavioral therapy does. The Buddha described awareness as the ability to verbally describe and consciously evaluate any thought, emotion, or sensation as it is happening in the moment. Meditation also complements psychological disciplines by enhancing body awareness. Cognitive understanding is important for regulating thoughts and emotions, but it may not on its own relieve habitual muscle tension. Relaxation not only disarms the physical effects of anxiety, it also grounds us in our bodies and gives us a non-verbal, muscular, visceral sense of self. This gives us a solid basis and a stance from which to observe thoughts objectively. We can see them as being outside the body, somewhat detached from us. This enables us to stop a thought in its tracks, evaluate it, and decide whether to stay with it or not. If a thought won't go away, we can at least quarantine it and marginalize its effect.